We are talking today with Dr. Bill Dienst and Greta Berlin. They are both co-editors of the new book, Freedom Sailors. Bill and Greta, thank you very much for coming and spending time with us this morning.
Thank you.
Good morning, Mike.
So start out and tell us, what was your motivation in putting together your book, Freedom Sailors?
I think our motivation was probably to get the message out about that first trip. A lot of people know about the massacres on board the Mavi Marmara, which was on Freedom Sailors, and how the Israelis murdered 9 of our passengers. But not very many people realized that we had gone several times before then, and we'd actually gotten in for 5 times. And so this particular book is about our first trip.
And I was in the medical officer of that trip, and Greta was the main, or one of the 5 main organizers of the Free Gaza movement. And literally, we were in uncharted waters. No one had ever tried to do this before. It had been 41 years of a maritime siege that Israel had imposed on the Gaza Strip, and we were the first ones to challenge that in 41 years. And literally, we didn't have any idea what was going to happen, nor did they.
I mean, the book really does say Freedom Sailors, the story about the maiden voyage of the Free Gaza movement and how we made it in spite of ourselves, because everything that could go wrong did go wrong. By the time the 44 of us finally got there in Gaza, we were exhausted. We were sure that we were going to be bombed out of the water. We had waited and waited and waited in Cyprus for 3.5 weeks to get for the boats to come. The boats were 2 derelict sailing boats that the Greeks had found for us. Of course, we as the passengers, 44 of us, thought they were the most beautiful boats in the world. They reeked of fish. We were sick most of the voyage over. It took us 33 hours from Cyprus to Gaza because the boats only went 6 miles an hour.
And it sounds like a straightforward issue, just sailboats to Cyprus to Gaza. How hard is that? It's only 250 nautical miles or so. There was a precedent. There was, in 1988, there was what was called the PLO Ship of Return. Organizers in Cyprus had set up a boat that was to take clergymen and elders and Palestinian refugees back into the port of Haifa, people who had been displaced in 1948. But to make a long story short, the boat was sabotaged by Israeli frogmen, and they blew up the engine in Limassol Harbor. And then the next day, the 3 organizers were killed in a car bomb. So that's what we had to go with. So our operation was clandestine in that we tried to make it very difficult for the Israelis to know where the boats were in the first place. And we employed people from Greece who were well-versed in clandestine operations. They had participated in the overthrow of the Greek fascist dictatorship in 1974, and so things were done on a need-to-know basis. That is, Greece is wonderful in that it has lots of islands, lots of harbors, lots of coves, lots of boats, and we kept the boats in their original Greek names. The first boat that became the Liberty was known as Agios Nikolaos, which is St. Nicholas in Greek. Well, how common is that? And the second boat, Dimitrios Kappa, became the Free Gaza. They were kept in separate harbors around Athens, 1 2-hour north and 1 on an island to the south. And meanwhile, Greta was providing misinformation to the spies who were trying to find the boats. Greta, tell us about that.
I was. I was in charge of writing all the press releases. So I would write a press release and I would say the boats are leaving Egypt. They're just leaving Alexandria, and the Egyptian port authorities would call the port authorities in Cyprus and say, you know, we have some Israelis down here. They're asking about these 2 boats, the Free Gaza and the Liberty. Well, of course, they were never there. And then 4 days later, I'd write another one and say, well, they've arrived in Turkey, and they're getting ready to leave Turkey. We drove them crazy. And one of the reasons that we did that, as Bill has said, is because we knew that the precedent that was set is that they had murdered 3 Palestinian organizers in 1988, and they were going to do anything that they could to either sabotage our boats before we got there or maybe even hurt some of us who are organizers. I also want to say that the main reason that we went is because when Israel pulled their illegal squatters out of Gaza in 2005, they said that Gaza was free. They said, okay, we're gone. Gaza is free. So we didn't have to ask for permission from Israel to sail into Gaza. That was the loophole that they left open for us. We said, fine, we're going to go from international waters straight into the waters of Gaza. We've been invited, and there's no reason for Israel to stop us. And in fact, Israel did not stop us for five voyages. We got in five times before they began to hijack the boats.
But we did have some delusional thinking. We're thinking, hell, we'll go into Gaza and then we'll come out. Hell, we'll set up a ferry service.
Yeah.
We truly believed at one point that we were going to set up a ferry service from Cyprus to Gaza. But you know, we learned later that that was not going to be permitted. And so we challenged the hypothesis and found out that the siege is still in place and Gaza still is not free.
It took us 2 years. We started working, those of us who were the organizers, started working when Israel had started to bomb Lebanon in 2006. And somebody had come up with the idea. He was an Australian volunteer from the International Solidarity Movement. And he said, look, I have this great idea. I really, really think it would be wonderful if we could take a boat and we could sail it from New York to Gaza. And those of us who were organizing thought, wow, what a fabulous idea. We had no idea. Most of us had no boat experience. In fact, even the Greeks who bought the boats for us, when they put the steering column on the Free Gaza and the captain got on board the Free Gaza, he turned the boat right and the boat went left. He put the boat forward and the boat went backwards because it was put on backwards. So we were really, what do you call us?
A motley crew or
a ship of fools?
A ship of fools. Well, it was amazing that we didn't degenerate into a ship of fools. And I, once Greta finishes her comments, I will comment on that specifically.
What is amazing is that the 44 people that came from 17 countries managed to get along at all. We had one common goal, and that was to break Israel's illegal siege of Gaza. No matter what we ended up doing, no matter how angry we got at each other, Bill will tell you a little bit about that, we still kept that goal in sight.
Yeah, just imagine you take people from 17 different countries and they have different cultures, different languages, different customs, and you put them on a ship together, and then you have delays and you have fear and you have paranoia and you have stress. There's bound to be internal conflict. The patterns are almost predictable. And several of us, myself included, were delegated to actually play referee and try to keep people from, you know, losing track of the greater goal. And literally, we were at risk of degenerating into a ship of fools, but we overcame those tendencies. And I think if anyone who knows political human rights or activists, so social activists, it's like herding cats. And I don't think that, I think folks here in the Seattle area would be quite familiar with that if you do activism at all.
It's not only herding cats, it's trying to put a set of tin cans on the back of a cat's tail and then letting them go. Because we not only had different cultures and different languages, but we began to have the Cyprus crew, that was about 33 of us who were waiting for the boats, and then we had the boat crew, and that was around 11 people who were trying to get the boats down to Cyprus. So by the time the boats got there, 3.5 weeks late, nobody was talking to anybody else. The boat people were dirty, they hadn't had showers, they had been on these boats, they had gone through all kinds of weather, and of course those of us waiting in Cyprus had been waiting for 3.5 weeks. The organizers, which were about four of us, were trying to think of ways to keep these people busy for 3.5 weeks. So we were having them write out wills, which in retrospect was a pretty good idea considering that the Israelis murdered 9 of us 2 years later. And one of the stories that we had a Palestinian who was on board, his name was Mushir Al-Farah, and he was from Khan Yunis in Gaza. So we were talking about if we die, if the Israelis kill us, what do we want to do with the bodies? And most of us said, just throw us overboard. After all, we're dead. Mushir said, no, I want to get to Gaza, so put me in the refrigerator.
Mushir was born in Gaza in Khan Yunis, so he was going home.
He was also 6'2" tall and weighed about 220 pounds. And the refrigerator could hold, what, Bill, maybe 2 cans of Coke?
Yeah, something like that. I think we would have to chop him up into tiny pieces to get him back to Gaza in the refrigerator. But anyway.
Well, and he was perfectly willing. He said, look, I'm dead. Take the parts of me. Parts are parts. So that's what we were trying so hard to keep people interested and people involved. Ironically, even though we were gone, and I think we were 3.5 weeks delayed, only 4 people left. And the 4 people who left, left because they ran out of time. We were supposed to go July 31st. We didn't go until August 22nd.
Yeah, they had to get back to their real lives and their real jobs back in their countries of origin.
So when you came up with this idea, how did you, A, get the funding and, B, get the word out to find people that wanted to do this?
I think people need to remember that in 2006, there was no Twitter. There was no Facebook. I think there was a MySpace. But there was nothing like there is now, and the only thing that we had was Google. And so we put this all together on Google lists, and we had we being the 5 organizers, had a fairly large list of ISM, International Solidarity Movement volunteers that had already gone to the West Bank and Gaza. So we started with them. And then, of course, they talked to somebody else, and then somebody else talked to somebody else. I think what's important about this book, Freedom Sailors, and also the fact that it was the first trip, is that it was truly an initiative of just common people. And people were sending us their Social Security checks. They were sending us the USS Liberty survivors. They were the ones that had their ship almost blown apart in 1967 by the Israelis. They were sending us their pension checks.
By the way, 34 sailors died and 171 were wounded in that action, and it still hasn't been investigated by the U.S. Congress.
And they found out. They had it really spread by word of mouth. They found out what we were doing. And they also found out that we were naming the second boat, the Liberty. And they were so touched that we would do that. And, of course, our Israeli partner had said to us, name the second boat the Liberty, because Israel is not going to be stupid enough to blow the Liberty up twice. It turned out.
Imagine the headlines. Israeli Navy destroys the Liberty again. Well, what was the first one? That might raise some questions, perhaps.
So that's how we had gotten the name of the Liberty. And we had people from Burma, for example. We had people from South Africa. They were donating $1.50. They were donating $2. We had one Iraqi man who actually stepped up and donated $100,000 to us. By the time we left out of Cyprus on the 22nd of August, we had had to raise close to $750,000. That's how much it cost us. And we've asked the people of Gaza many times, look, would you prefer having that money? And they've always said, no, we prefer having our freedom. And you gave us a taste of that.
Let me comment on that for a minute. You know, I've been in and out of Gaza many times since 1985, and my first time is like I'm going to the third world to save these backward people. Well, that's totally wrong. When you get there, what you discover is they have doctors and they have engineers and they have all kinds of people who are highly educated, who have been educated all around the world back in the days when people could come and go. But their infrastructure is being deliberately sabotaged by the siege. They have cancer specialists, for example, but medical oncology drugs are not being allowed in. And so they have the means, again, and they do get a lot of charity. The United Nations Relief and Works Agency, all kinds of non-government organizations do relief work in Gaza. But these people, if given their freedom, could have a reasonably good society, and that goes for the West Bank as well.
And I think it's important for people to realize that we were not a bunch of internationals that were going in to save the people of Gaza. We were a bunch of internationals, including Palestinians, that were going in to make sure that the world understood that 1.5 million people are in a concentration camp. They can't get in. They can't get out. The only way they really can sustain themselves are through the tunnels, and the tunnels are often blown up. And we wanted to make a statement that said, Israel, you don't have any right to do this. You don't have a right to lay siege on 1.5 million people, of which 50% or more, I think Bill probably knows, are under the age of 18. It's mostly children.
It's over 50%. I don't remember the exact figure, but it's well over 50% are under 18.
So I think that's why most of us decided to go originally, and because so many of us who were on that first trip had been denied entrance into the West Bank, into the occupied West Bank, we thought, well, the easiest way for us to get back into Palestinian territories is to go by boat. Oh, this should be simple. We'll just get on a boat and we'll just we'll just sail from Cyprus to Gaza. We had no idea, of course, that on the night that we sailed, a Mistral had come in from Morocco.
And explain what that is.
A Mistral is a huge wind that comes across the Mediterranean and drops red dust on everybody. It's not a storm. It just pulls the waves up as high as 3 or 4 feet.
It is high winds, though.
It is definitely high winds, and we're in two wooden sailing boats that are overloaded because the boats were commissioned for 11 or 12 people, and we've got 24 people on the Free Gaza, and we've got 19 people or 20 people on the Liberty. In retrospect, I often think, I cannot believe I was one of the major organizers and talked these people into getting on board these shipwrecks. Our Irish first mate looked at the boats and he said, he goes, these are a bunch of shipwrecked boats. You're going on these boats? He said, don't blame me if you fall overboard because I'm not coming to get you. And
I think she deleted a word that, yeah, that can't be mentioned on the air.
I'm being polite. Yes, that was true. Because, of course, once we got on board and we got out to sea, we all got sick. Everybody got seasick, some more than others. And Derek, our Irish first mate, had attached these bungee cords to the side of the boat so that if we heaved ourselves overboard or our stomachs overboard, we weren't going to fall overboard. And it worked. I mean, we didn't lose anybody. But we definitely had no idea when it got dark that night on the night of the 22nd of August. The Israelis cut off all of our communication. Gone.
Let me talk about that. We had invested maybe $10,000 in real life. $30,000 in real life internet streaming, and we thought we were clever. We thought that if they attacked us, we'd just broadcast it worldwide, and that would be our only defense. Again, we were completely unarmed, nonviolent, direct action activists. But they beat us in the information technology tennis match in that we got a beam of, we were 70 miles out to sea with the Israeli border abeam, and all of a sudden our satellite phones went dead, our GPS went dead. They even blocked Channel 16. Now, Seattle is a Mariner community, and a lot of you out there know that Channel 16 is the universal distress worldwide, is that if your boat is going down and you're shouting Mayday, hopefully the Coast Guard or somebody will come to your aid. Well, that was blocked for us, and all we had was this sinister voice saying, "They are lost. They are lost." And we were cut off from the world. Well, guess what? The Greeks, the Greek government, the Cypriot government, the Arab League, and Al Jazeera were all, they all thought we were lost.
Greta. I think they all thought that we were dead because we disappeared for at least 14 to 15 hours. I mean, it was probably longer than that. We disappeared the entire night. So however long that night was, we were gone. We had no idea. We had walkie-talkies so we could talk to the boats back and forth. And that's about all that we could do. We could at least stay out of each other's way, and we had the lights on the boats. But it was dead dark. We saw nobody. And Jeff Halper, who is the Israeli, who's in charge of the Israeli Committee Against House Demolitions, I think that's right. He said, listen, if they're going to come after you, it's going to be frogmen. They're going to come up over the side of the boat, and you'll never know what hit you. So, of course, nobody slept. I mean, we were sick. Fortunately, I was only sick for one time, so I ended up being on watch with some of the crew. And what were we watching for? Well, we couldn't see anything. We were watching to make sure that we didn't hit each other.
It was a dark, stormy night, anyway.
When it was a dark, stormy. It was a dark, stormy night. No rain, but it was definitely stormy. When the sun came up that next morning. And I also want to emphasize what Bill just said. There was nobody on board those boats that was famous. This was truly a voyage of activists, a voyage of just simple people, teachers, nurses. We had a nun on board. They were people who believed in freedom and justice for the Palestinians. There was one, Lauren Booth, who was Tony Blair's sister-in-law, was on board because she felt that at least the UK would give them some publicity because she was on board. She was right, by the way. But otherwise, we were just activists, direct activists. And we, there was, out of the 44 of us, there were probably only 8 or 9 that had any sea experience. I mean, my experience was sailing a sailboat in a lake. So I thought, oh, woohoo, you know, I'll just get on this boat and we'll just sail across.
Boy, how naive we were, I'll tell you. When you have that open water, there's just nothing to buffer the waves. And, you know, well over probably 80% of the passengers got seasick. But somehow, and then we waited in the middle of the night for the Israeli Navy to latch onto our boats and haul us to prison. But somehow the sun rose and there were no warships on the horizon. And there we were out on the wide blue horizon, two synchronous sailing vessels bobbing back and forth. And we were then, our satellite finally, we kept one satellite off the whole time. And our news media guy on the Free Gaza turned it on. And he called his office of Al Jazeera or
Al Jazeera.
Tell the rest.
We'd had enough sense to say maybe we should keep one phone off because Israel was very good at blocking that kind of communication. So when it got light, we asked the Al Jazeera guy, who was deathly ill, by the way, along with everybody else, and could barely speak. We said, can you turn on your radio? He goes, okay. And he turned on his satellite phone, and it worked. It worked. We were maybe 30 or 40 miles off the coast of Gaza. And he called his office, and he said, we're alive. And although we didn't know that at the time, there was a scroll on the bottom of both Al Jazeera English and Al Jazeera Arabic that said, they are alive. They are alive. The Free Gaza, the passengers on both the free, on board the Free Gaza and the Liberty are alive. As a result, the Greek government called Israel, and I think the Cypriot government called as well, and the Arab League said, we're holding you responsible for the safety of these passengers on board. There was a member of the Greek parliament who was on board the Liberty. And so for whatever reason, Israel decided that they would let us through. They weren't going to block us.
And Foreign Minister Tzipi Livni then made a proclamation that they would let the boats pass because they are peaceful activists, or words to that effect. And this, after months of threatening us in the worst possible ways, in all different ways they were threatening us, they finally acknowledged that we were nonviolent activists who are harmless individuals.
And I think that that's what people need to understand, because Israel continued after the first 5 trips to say they were stopping our boats because they were so afraid that maybe we were going to have munitions on board, It's completely ridiculous. The boats are always inspected from the port that they leave. But the thing that was really important is that we got in 5 times. They didn't stop us the first time. I personally think, having worked with the media for the entire time, that what Israel thought was, look, these are a bunch of stupid hippies. Many of us had come out of the 60s. We were long-term veterans of South Africa and the civil rights movement in the United States. Oh, just let them go. They're a bunch of old people. Let them go. Let them go in. They'll go away. They had no idea that we were never going to go away.
Yeah, we'll keep this going. We'll keep this going. So anyway, so that was, there was, you know, after feeling hopeless, there was great euphoria on board the vessels, and we sailed into Gaza territorial waters, and pretty soon you could see the Gaza skyline, and it shined like an emerald. But as we got closer, it was obvious that Gaza's overcrowded. Wall-to-wall inhabitation from the beach refugee camp to the central Gaza city district down to the refugee camp of Deir al-Balah people. But we had a passenger on board, Moshir Farah, who was born in Khan Yunis, Gaza, and it was most meaningful for him. And I don't know if we can paraphrase what he had to say.
He was the only person who was from Gaza who was on board. We had Hawida Al-Araf, who is actually an Israeli citizen, but she's Palestinian as well. But Moshir wanted to go back. He wanted to go back because when his mother was dying, they did not let him. The Israelis would not allow him in, as though somehow they had the right to tell him he couldn't come home when his mother was dying. And so he wrote the most beautiful and elegant piece in this book. I don't want to paraphrase it because I want people to buy the book, And they can buy it from, if they just go to freedomsailors.com, they can order it through Amazon, or they can order it, actually you can get an electronic copy as well.
You can get a Kindle edition as well as a book edition. So go to www.freedomsailors.com and order the book. It's great.
It's funny also. I mean, Bill and I have been doing this now as far as book events for the last week, and audiences laugh all the time. I mean, we were so dumb. Audiences hear our stories and they think, you're still alive? You're standing here talking to us? Mm-hmm. That's what's so remarkable.
Yeah, but I also want to just kind of give you a picture of what it was to arrive in Gaza. Because we really wondered if anybody would care. But when we arrived, there were 40,000 people on the shoreline. There were boats coming out chock full of people to greet us. And when we got into the marina, there were little kids swimming out to the boats. There were dignitaries boarding our boats. The boats became overloaded with passengers. We were 200 yards from docking, and we thought we'd sink right there in the harbor there for a while until the police came aboard and established order. But it was glorious pandemonium. It was glorious. It is something that I swear I will remember for as long as I live.
Yeah, I think for every one of us, especially for those of us who are organizers who had been doing this for 2 years, we couldn't believe it. We really couldn't believe that we had actually landed in Gaza. And I also think that the back part of the book is something that's really important, because even though the first three quarters of it is all of the trials and tribulations to get there, the back part of this book has a lot about what we saw when we were in Gaza. And then there's also a chapter on the real reason that Israel's doing this with Gaza, which is to steal the natural gas that belongs to Gaza. 4.3 trillion cubic feet of natural gas belongs to the people of Gaza, enough to make them into a mini Singapore. And Israel has derricks already built along the border between Israel and Gaza. And although we can't prove that they're slant drilling, the chances are, of course, that they are stealing it, because they've already set a precedent. They've stolen everything else. The olive trees, the water, they're obviously going to steal the natural gas of Gaza. That's the real reason that Gaza is a closed-off enclave, because they don't want the people of Gaza to be successful, to be the mini Singapore, to be able to go to school and go to medical school and go to the hospital. They want to keep them enclosed until they suck out all the natural gas.
And the take-home message is that we need to know that our tax dollars, $3 billion in military aid a year, are supplementing this Israeli intransigence. And if we really want peace in the Middle East, we have to stop it. And we have to push for liberty and justice for all people who live there. All Jews, Muslims, Christians, everyone.
All right. Well, with that, we are unfortunately out of time. I want to thank you both for coming and spending time with us this morning.
Thank you very much, Michael.
Thank you. We thoroughly enjoyed it.
Again, we've just been talking with Dr. Bill Dienst and Greta Berlin. They are both co-editors of the new book, Freedom Sailors, which you can get online and via their website, freedomsailors.com.